This is Art Moves, a series of curated conversations at the dynamic intersection of art, innovation, and social justice. Each week, we'll be talking to the visionary thinkers and doers who are forging new ground in creative arts while redefining what it means to be creative. I'm Toni Williams.
And I'm Eli Kislansky, and we're your hosts for Art Moves.
In today's episode, we have the honor of speaking with Sean Decatur, an esteemed and accomplished leader in academia and the arts and the president of the American Museum of Natural History. As the first African-American president, Decatur brings his passion for education and his commitment to diversity to one of the oldest and most revered institutions in the world of natural history, art, and science. Join us as we delve into Decatur's inspiring journey and his vision for the future of the museum. Welcome, Sean Decatur.
Thank you, Toni and Eli. Thank you for having me today.
Well, you know, we have something to thank you for, and that is our tour of the Museum of Natural History. And I just have to say this, you make me proud. And I say that with all deference, because walking into that space and knowing that there was an African-American whose perspective and vision is laden in that, is embedded in that, gave me a different sense of belonging. I was so awestruck, actually. Really, I just really had such a different experience. The last time that I really remember being in the museum was when they used to give us those big souvenir pencils way back in the day. But having you there, I'm just so excited about what you're going to bring and what your leadership, how your leadership's going to inform the exhibits and everything that we see there.
There is something about the museum.
It's kind of magical.
It's magical. It is, and it really does just inspire a sense of wonder. You know, I had the great joy of taking my grandnephew, who's just turned four and is obsessed with dinosaurs, and we walked through the museum, and you know, his mouth and eyes were wide open the entire time with excitement of everything that he was seeing. And I should say he was able to name far more dinosaur specimens than I was able to name, but that sense of magic and wonder
it's alive. I mean, yeah. The crystals, oh man, when I saw those amethyst geodes, it was like, wow. But anyway, so you can see that we're both really, really excited. But let me kick this off with a question just around your leadership journey. You know, can you share with our listeners the journey that led you to your current role as president of the American Museum of Natural History? And what were those key milestones that really, that you felt prepared you for this, for where you are now?
And my path in some ways is unusual to come into a museum leadership role. And certainly if you'd asked me maybe even 2 years ago whether I imagined this is where I'd be at this moment, I think I would be shocked if you had kind of looked into the future. As a kid, I grew up really interested in science. I grew up in Cleveland, Ohio, and my mom was a math teacher, and on weekends, she would sign me up to any type of after-school program, weekend program that had to do with science and math.
Like a good mother teacher should.
Exactly. And one of those was at the Cleveland Museum of Natural History. And so I remember going to camp programs and programs there. And it's actually a place where I was introduced to what it meant to do science research and what science looked like. And then I went on to study science. I was interested in science in college, was led by some really great mentors, encouraged to go to graduate school, where I studied biophysical chemistry, which is sort of problems at the intersection of physics, chemistry, and biology, or ways that we can use physical chemistry to understand how biological systems work. But through that, my big interest beyond the scientific problems was how do you teach and engage others and mentor others to become scientists. Especially, I was interested in finding ways to increase the broader participation and representation among scientists. So, African Americans are still greatly underrepresented among folks in the scientific profession. Women in many areas of science are still very underrepresented. And you can go through many groups, Latina, mm-hmm. Folks, Native Americans, others are underrepresented. And so I wanted to pursue a career where I could not only study scientific problems, but could really be involved in mentoring, supporting, and changing the dynamics of the scientific community and creating opportunities for more people to be engaged in the study of science. And so I left when I graduated with my PhD. I started an academic career. Mm-hmm. I taught at Mount Holyoke College. I built a research program. It was wonderful at Mount Holyoke because it's a women's institution.
Yes.
And so
mm-hmm.
being able to really be at the vanguard of helping to educate and support women who went on to careers in the sciences, and then gradually became an administrator over time. Ending my academic career, or at least that phase of my academic career, as president of Kenyon College in Ohio, where I was for about 10 years. And then, the opportunity came up at the American Museum of Natural History, and it wasn't something I was imagining, but as I learned more, the AMNH is a place with a strong reputation and history and activity and scientific research, but of course also a strong commitment to bringing science to a broader population and engaging in education. It's also a degree granting institution with a graduate program.
Which is phenomenal. Right.
So mm-hmm. all of those things, to me, it really has felt like the kind of the ultimate
dream job
for my career.
Right?
And
yes.
So it's been terrific at this transition.
So I'd like to talk a little bit about the legacy. The museum has a rich history of not only just education and science research, but also innovation that goes back many, many years ago. From one of the first use of dioramas to like how you pose the dinosaurs to a more active stance, et cetera, and of course in the education programs. So I'd like you to talk a little bit about the range of activities and how you see going forward, how you build upon the legacy and then steer the museum towards a new and innovative direction.
Yes, the museum has been a very innovative place, both in terms of us scientific research, but also in terms of its education, exhibition, and sort of public understanding work. On the research side of things, this is a place where the early discoveries in paleontology are almost legendary within the field and more broadly, a place where T-Rex was not only first discovered and first displayed and named at the American Museum of Natural History. And that tradition of
You said and named?
So the name T-Rex was from the curatorial leadership at the American Museum of Natural History from an expedition. So
there's a very rich legacy that the museum, very deep and rich legacy that most people actually don't know.
That, exactly.
Yes.
That's an example of one.
And it mm-hmm. continues to today. So we still, we have a strong research science program. It's about 200 folks who work in our science division. We send folks out on expeditions around the world to continue to collect specimens and samples, about 100 expeditions or so a year. We have a collection of over 30 million objects and specimens that really tell the story of the history of life on the planet. Are a powerful resource for scientists who come to the museum from all over the world to access specimens that really are unavailable anywhere else. So there's that strong history and legacy as a research institution, as a institution that has just provided great insights into understanding the natural world. And at the same time, this institution that has brought science to the public in lots of creative ways, not only through the dioramas and the historic dioramas, which are stunning works of art, but through its education outreach programs that again actually date back hundreds of years. And that close engagement between the museum staff and schools, especially schools in New York City, mm-hmm. Goes back a long time. I think I think many people in New York remember the museum through field trips, and we still have hundreds of thousands of kids each year.
We saw many kids. I mean, they were all over the place. It was wonderful at all ages, quite honestly.
Exactly. No, right. And it's one of the things that gives me a great deal of energy every day is to see the energy of the young kids as they're coming through the museum on field trips. And that tradition is still very strong. And we've taken it in some new, exciting directions. And so just this year, we started a program where fourth and fifth grade classes from New York City are invited to be in residence at the museum for a week. So those fourth and fifth graders spend the full week at the museum. They do all of their, they come to school at the museum in the morning. They do all of their classwork using museum exhibitions as launching pads for conversation. And it's amazing to see these kids who really, for that week, the school, the museum is their school. And, you come in the morning, they'll be spread out on the floor of the atrium working on their assignments because they're there before the building's open, kind of doing their classwork. That creative work between the museum staff and the education program and the New York City schools, it goes back deep in its history and it continues today and has a real strong impact on the youth of the city and certainly a strong impact on what it means to inspire students to go on to careers in the sciences.
You're listening to Art Moves on WNYE 91.5 FM, and we're talking to Sean Decatur.
Yes, I'd like to do a follow-up question about that. We talked about a little bit previously to the show about this idea about science literacy and the role that museums play in contemporary science and contemporary society. Is the goal science literacy the right one, or is it conversion in science, or how do we break past this sort of almost like wall of ignorance, if you will?
Right. No, and certainly one of the goals I have in terms of expanding understanding of science is really to open up windows into viewing and witnessing, getting a sense of what the scientific process is like. Because I think that some of the challenges to distrust of science, a sense that people don't
have
confidence.
Which we're seeing so much now, which is hard to believe, quite honestly.
Exactly.
Science is where you went for facts.
Right. And I think some of that is rooted in that, not understanding fully how those facts are generated. And the process that leads to a set of conclusions that scientists put forward. And I think the process is important because science actually changes, and it changes for good reason, because sometimes new ideas come up and new ideas overturn old ideas, and that's part of the process.
And that's what we have to adapt to, because it's almost as if you want to say science is truth, not necessarily.
Well, that's
right?
The thing. It's a fallacy of belief that it's a finite, done thing.
Exactly.
It's like perfect.
It's evolving,
Just
like
way.
History.
Right. So one of the things, and it's actually one of the new sets of displays at the museum that opened up with the new Gilder Center for Science Education Innovation,
which opened about
a year ago. Beautiful building.
Beautiful.
But one of the displays in the building is what we call the Science Collections Core. And the Collections Core is a series of galleries that show not only samples of objects from the collection, but attempt to tell the story of how that object came to be in the collection, how it's actively used by scientists, and what it means, what's the significance there. And to me, that's important for opening up the process of discovery. So how did something get discovered and brought there in the first place? What its value is and how scientists are actively using it. And then what are we learning from that has an impact on our lives? And the more we can make that full arc visible and give people insight into the process of scientific discovery, the more confidence I think people will have in the scientific information that they see.
It's interesting because you said how things get there. And when it comes to museums, that's always a question. How do you get your objects? Where do they come from? Can you talk to us about the closure of those galleries, the Eastern Woodlands and the Great Plains, and the process that you went through based on, of course, this federal act that happened? But I really find it just so interesting the way that the American Museum of Natural History has approached this and resolved it.
Yeah, so you know, the museum has collected in a number of areas, most of them in the natural and physical sciences. So, geology and earth science and biological sciences and things. Exactly.
I love that. Yeah. I love that.
But the museum was also, from the very beginning, had a program in anthropology and in human cultures. And the collection practices in that area have, and what we consider ethical collection practices now, have really changed a great deal in the past 150 years. And so there are objects in our collection, especially objects that represent and really belong to indigenous cultures in North America, that were taken from communities without the set of permissions and consent and really fair compensation and
some folks
and fair representation.
Stolen, you know? Yes, yes.
These include not just physical objects, but actually include ancestral remains that were taken from burial sites. It includes other physical objects that would have come from burial sites that we would consider funerary objects that were clearly buried with ancestors for a purpose. And so to remove them from those grave sites is actually very much a direct harm to the communities from which they were taken. Includes sacred objects that were and are used in ceremony that were never meant to be taken away from the community and put on display in a museum and not to be actively used. So many museums, including the American Museum of Natural History, are undergoing an important reckoning with this past. How do we return return ancestors who should be returned to communities, to return objects that should be returned to communities, to make sure that we are displaying objects with the consent of the descendant communities and the communities that from which the objects came. In our Eastern Woodlands and Great Plains halls, there were a number of objects, actually, on the scale of about 1,600 objects that fell into that category of things that were funerary objects, sort of taken from grave sites, things that were sacred objects, things that had that were considered objects of cultural patrimony of particular cultural significance, and this, both, I think, fundamentally the right thing to do, but also what now is dictated by regulation, those things can only be displayed with the consent of the communities. So we have made the decision to close those halls, to engage in a process of consultation with communities about either consent to display or return of items that should be returned, and to begin to center the ways in which we represent and tell stories of indigenous cultures in the museum, center the voices of the indigenous communities as we do that work. And a good example of that is a hall that we renovated in the museum just a couple of years ago that features objects, artifacts from the Pacific Northwest and the indigenous communities of sort of Northwest US and into British Columbia and further north in Canada. And that hall was renovated with the curatorial input of members of those communities who helped to make decisions about how the objects are displayed, who had input into the setup and arrangement of the hall so that the stories there.
I imagine they felt very, was that like a record? Yeah, acknowledged, respected,
this
a
is
kind of reconciliation,
sacrilege.
Creating a relationship that can go forward, I imagine.
It's also, right. Also shifting cultural lenses because before is very Eurocentric and from the collector's point of view as opposed to the indigenous culture.
Right. Mm-hmm. And I think that certainly was the goal, and I think the outcome of sort of building some lasting relationships. So I have to say that work is really hard, right? Because to many members and, and I've heard this from members of indigenous communities who've come to the museum that it can be a painful experience.
I can imagine. It's like,
no, I just can't imagine. Sure, of course.
All your stuff is out there. I mean, I hate to say it that way because, right.
And so.
Who would have thought? I mean, but because sometimes we just don't think.
Well, and that notion that. The meaning, that in some cultures, these are objects that are sort of meant to be used in ceremony, meant to
be part of a ritual, kind of cultural life. It's like taking the Eucharist or anything or communion. I mean, you don't do those things, but the sensitivity wasn't there. So it's wonderful to see that coming back.
Right.
You're listening to Art Moves on WNYE 91.5 FM, and we're talking to Sean Decatur. Just to stay with that for a moment, it's the collaboration, the respect that you're having for Indigenous communities. Is there anything else you'd like to share with us on that?
This is going to be ongoing work at the museum, looking forward to some time. I think it's important for us to engage in this work in true partnership and collaboration. That means doing work to help to build trust and recognizing that the historical legacy of the institution has eroded a lot of that potential for trust. So we have work to do to re-earn and to rebuild trust and confidence in those relationships. And to be creative at the ways in which we reach out to tell these stories or to bring these stories in the museum. Another exhibit that just opened this spring in the Northwest Coast Hall is called Grounded by Our Roots. And it features contemporary artists from the Indigenous nations of Northwest U.S. and in British Columbia and in Canada to produce and to have art that's in conversation with the objects in the collection. And so that helped to extend the stories into current moment, to be in commentary about the relationship of not only the museum, but the U.S. and Canadian governments in those nations in terms of the damage done to those cultures and how that can be expressed in contemporary art. To me, it also emphasizes, one of the things that I've found and heard from some visitors to the museum, which I feel is really heartbreaking and we need to correct, is this notion that the cultures that are represented in the museum are sort of dead cultures in the past and that they're not living cultures today. Mm-hmm. And I think we have an obligation to not only make sure that we are representing the past in a respectful way that brings in the voices of those communities, but also to show the what the descendant communities are doing now and the state of the descendant communities and the perspective of the contemporary communities into the conversation as well, so that folks don't leave the museum thinking that these are the cultures of the past, that these are actually living, breathing cultures and peoples that are here with us today.
I think Sean has power in his humility. The way that you're speaking about these Indigenous communities, if this is how the museum is moving forward, they're in really, really good shape, because it's just, there has to be a degree of humility when you're repairing something, right? There must be.
Yeah. It also points to this idea of a living museum.
Yes.
Because
yes.
The perception of the general public is us, a lot of dead stuff in vitrines, why go there? So, So I think, I think this, we should talk about Ice Cold, which I personally was blown away by.
Were you blown away?
Yes, I was.
I want, because he's so subtle. He's kind of like, okay, I'm glad to see that you like that ASAP Rocky.
No, I love
choker.
That stuff.
Did you see that?
It was amazing.
I thought the stuff was brilliant, not just for the design and the representation of the culture it represents, but also for the fact that here is an exhibit that's trying to reach, not just reach very hard to reach audiences, which is people who don't believe they belong in, people who don't see themselves in museums, were accurate. And also to reach hard to reach audiences like teens, right?
Right. Right.
So it'd be great, you know, talk a little bit about that. And I think the other thing too, the last thing, right, one point, is that it also connects to the other, it's like a easy entry point to the rest of the collection. That's really what I want to say.
Oh, it certainly is. And how much did that cost? Did you have a figure for the value of all that stuff?
So actually the amazing thing is that those pieces are all on loan from the artist. And so they have made them available to be on display at the museum, which is terrific. And so the exhibit is called Ice Cold. It's an exhibition of hip hop jewelry. It opened opened just last week, but will be up and open through early January. And for me, this is really exciting because it does use traditional natural history objects, so gems, mm-hmm. and gems have been part of the museum from the very beginning. And there's the Mignone Halls of Gems and Minerals, which is right next to the Ice Cold exhibit. But it uses those natural history objects to tell a very a type of cultural story that sometimes gets ignored or left out of a place like AM&H. And so in this case, ways in which jewelry can be seen as not only as a window into the history of hip hop, and this has pieces of jewelry from hip hop artists from 51 years ago, from the very early stages, includes a leather medallion from DJ Kool Herc, so about as early as you can get in the history of hip hop, all the way up through current times. And jewelry is an important means of self-expression and kind of putting one's identity out there.
It's always interesting.
Yeah. And the ways in which hip hop artists have used that is fascinating. And to see how that's changed over time is really interesting.
And it's interesting that you all were able to see the connection, because it's like, oh, the American Museum of Natural History is into the hip hop. But there is a point of entry, gems.
Yes.
Right. I thought that was just amazing.
Which is actually not a bad technique for all kinds of science type exhibits. It's like, how do you make them relevant to society, and that, how's it useful in life, and then, bring the science in. So I think it's to some degree.
And how well has it been received thus far?
I do think it's actually one of those moments for families to come and to have that sort of cross-generational conversation.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. You're the first African-American president of this natural history museum. Can you talk about any significant barriers that you've been breaking down? I hear one with the indigenous communities, but could you talk to us about some of the others, perhaps, or just by your very presence being there, any reflections that you've had about that?
It's certainly, I think, important to me. I think important to everyone at the museum that we continue to make a museum that is seen as a welcoming place to everyone, where everyone can find a sense that they belong and are invited into the space. And I drill down a little bit more deeply, where I think also that the scientific community and the scientific enterprise is something for everyone, that everyone can really see themselves as a scientist, and to have a place where role models in the sciences are brought forward in a way that everyone can see that. And, in terms of my presence, I think that it's critical for institutions, if they are going to be able to authentically advocate for diversity in a broader sense, or if we advocate for the importance of a sense of belonging at our cultural institutions, that the leadership and the staff have to reflect the diversity of the communities as well. And that's incredibly important for not only for our museum, but for cultural institutions more broadly.
Oh, that's wonderful. And unfortunately, that's all the time we have. I'd like to get you back, though, because we didn't get through a third of our questions. But anyway, thank you so much for the time that you've given us. And we are so looking forward to more interactions.
Thank you.
Well, that's all the time we have for today's episode of Art Moves. And to all our listeners, thank you for tuning in. For more information, visit us at artmoves.net. That's Art Moves with a Z. You can listen to Art Moves on Apple Podcasts and Spotify. Art Moves is co-produced with Bricks Arts Media and recorded at Bricks Studio in downtown Brooklyn. I'm Ilya Kaslansky.
I'm Tony Williams.
And until next time, keep exploring, keep creating, find some art that moves you, and share it.